The topic is humor, irony, and the challenge of self-understanding. As I think of having heard Holly's two lectures, this is going to be looking at bits, smaller pieces of life, and the imagination in terms of smaller pieces rather than whole stories as much. But the idea of imagination and Christian apologetics gives me a marvelously large umbrella to do all sorts of things I love to do. And particularly to recover two other words for Christian use, humor and irony. The Christian faith has sometimes been disdainful of humor and afraid of irony. I think those are both, I can see reasons for them, but severe mistakes. So I want to push back against these misunderstandings and show how, as we bring imagination into apologetics, where we can go. And at Mark's suggestion, he asked that I would particularly focus on some biblical material, and I'm very happy to do that. But since time is short and I have too much to say, as usual, I want to launch in and start with apologetics itself, the task of apologetics. Just to say a quick word, I don't see apologetics, though there's vast amounts of written on it. I see it not as essentially an academic discipline, but if it's worth its salt, it's going to help people talk to people who are not Christians, who they're sitting beside, walking beside, seeing in their lives, living beside, and to be able to talk meaningfully, seriously discuss the gospel of Jesus Christ and its truth. Whether they're hungry for it and open for it, or whether they're bitter and cynical and resentful against it. We need a full range of openness here. What I'm interested in is not just reducible to evangelism, but nor is it completely, is it inseparable from evangelism. In other words, I don't want it to be lost in academic discussion. I want it to be feeding and gearing to how we actually talk to real live people. This is partly because I've been working my life in Labrie, became a Christian in part through Francis Schaeffer, and it's what I've experienced. And what Labrie is a place where the apologetics we do is with people we're living with. And so it's a life exposure rather than just an idea exposure or even a trail of discourse in general. Most of what I'd be saying here would be Schaeffer would have called pre-evangelism. But I wanted to start with the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 10. this isn't the last word on apologetics, but it's very real and interesting take he has on his own burden. For the weapons of our warfare are not merely human, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every proud obstacle raised up against the knowledge of God. And we take every thought captive to obey Christ. Note from the start, since we're about imagination, he starts off with a metaphor. He starts off with what he's doing, whatever it is all about bashing down fortresses, knocking down protective walls. Walls that protect someone who is not a Christian from Christian truth. Because people are well protected by, as we've heard, by materialism, by ideas around them, by all kinds of things all around them. How can we get through those walls to actually have traction with the truth of Jesus Christ, with the life that someone is living, with the conscious reality they're struggling with day by day? It's the Christian in the power of God, and this is a part of the spiritual battle. You notice it's not merely human power, but divine power. We destroy arguments and every proud obstacle to knowledge of God. This is dealing with the spiritual battle here. It's not just dealing with people who love to argue, and letting off steam by arguing, or can't bear to give up being students and so like to argue with people. This is the spiritual battle where God is the major player. And it's trying to break down the wall and undeceive and disenchant and disillusion people with whatever these obstacles are that are standing between them and understanding and grasping the truth of Christ. And I want to emphasize destroying not only arguments, but every proud obstacle to the knowledge of God. And we have to realize it's not just an idea thing. It's not just a cognitive thing. It's not just something that has to do with the history of Western philosophy, Eastern philosophy, anything else. It's got to do with people's heroes. It's got to do with their possessions. It's got to do with their desires. It's got to do with their commitments to music. It's got to do with their memories. It's got to do with resentments to how their parents taught them. All that is on the table. All that can be hugely protective in terms of walls against the gospel. So talk about the need for imagination. To do this, we need enormous imagination to see where is the person living, what is really bugging them, how in the world can I get in and connect with what matters and where they may find traction. It takes a keen imagination and also prayer, because this is the power of God that we're after, not just our own winning arguments. We need to really see prayer as a vital part of this whole picture. I think you see Paul and perhaps even more Jesus doing what I would call fortress breaking repeatedly. That's the negative side of apologetics, the breaking down the fortress. The positive side is what he touches at the very end. We take every thought captive to obey Christ. Every thought captive. That means the positive persuasion of the Christian truth. A persuasion and a re-enchantment. We are disenchanting them with all sorts of things that they're enchanted with, that they shouldn't be enchanted with. We need to re-enchant, not just convince of certain facts. Showing Christ to be the truth they want to embrace, not reluctantly embrace, that they want to embrace. What they see in Jesus needs to be more than just convictions about what is factually true, as Holly's been saying. They need an imaginative reconstruction themselves of wanting to be the person who lives and walks following Jesus. Wanting that. Someone who's not a Christian who doesn't want to follow Christ as Lord. That's a hugely emotive, imaginative whole reconstruction that happens. So it's something much more than just the cognitive, but as she said, it's absolutely to do with the cognitive as we go along. Their two are inseparable. As Calvin wrote at his Institutes, I love the first few sentences of the Institutes are absolutely marvelous to me. He says, the two kinds of knowledge that are really important, knowledge of God and knowledge of ourselves, and this is a rough translation or collapse of Calvin, I can't for the life of me figure out which one comes first and leads to the other. Which one gives birth to the other, self-knowledge or God-knowledge? And what he's saying here is there's a feedback loop between self-understanding and God-understanding, and you can't separate them. You get to have the wrong view of yourselves, and you're going to mess up your view of God. You have the messed up view of God, you're going to have a warped view of yourself as well. And this we've got to get a hold of as we do apologetics, because as he said, these are the most important areas of knowledge. I would say they're the most important areas in apologetics. What do you think of God, or who do you think God is, and who in the world are you? Who are you? These have everything to do with each other. Let me give you the outline back here again. Where am I? Sorry. Do I want to install these things? No. Never mind. I don't have time to get you my outline again. In the limited time I've got, I'm not going to be able to talk very much about the specific God issues on apologetics. I want to talk more about the self-understanding issues of apologetics. First of all, for two reasons. One, that they're more neglected in apologetics in general, and two, because I believe today the issues are more of apologetics are more in anthropology than they are in theology. In other words, what is a human being is a huge question today and a more urgent question to most people who have long ago given up on God. Because of the constraints of this talk, I will leave out the God side, but I will be dealing more with the self-understanding side. Who are you?
What do you trust in? What do you hope in? What are your obstacles to knowing God? The Bible helps us with two primal events to help us to understand ourselves. First, we're gloriously created in God's image and likeness, able to reflect his character and commune with God. Then there was the fall, where we rebelled against our creator and benefactor, wanting independence, wanting rivalry with God, and bringing instead ruin down on our own heads, and sin warping us and our ability to commune with God, commune with each other, and commune with ourselves. Francis Schaeffer used to call it, some of you may have heard it this thousands of times, each person is a glorious ruin. Everybody, all of you sitting here, are glorious ruins. And that's the Christian understanding put in on a thumbnail of who we are living in this post-fall world. Pascal put it in his usual clarity. He says, it is dangerous to make a man see too clearly his equality with the brutes without showing him his greatness. It's also dangerous to make him see his greatness too clearly without showing him his vileness. But it is very advantageous to show him both. And so it's very advantageous to get a full grip on a Christian view of a human being. And that's only a Christian view. You need God to hold those two things together. You need this understanding of yourself, not because it's an interesting, curious thing to know, Pascal is saying, because if you don't know it, you're dangerous. So, contradiction, paradox, and irony are bound up in basic human identity, if we see our situation clearly and biblically. A Christian must have some grip on both sides of that, of who they are, of human nature, to be a Christian at all. The glory of who they are is loved by God, and the ruinous situation they're in. You think of Paul in Romans 7. I don't understand myself. He starts out that section, Romans 7, 14, and then goes on to say, I don't do the very good that I want to do. I do the evil I don't want to do, and so on. But then can get to victory at the end because he knows God loves him and God forgives him. But we need both sides with clarity. If our self-knowledge sees only our glory and not our ruin, we are arrogant, self-important, self-righteous. We have naive, utopian hopes, and we sense no need for God's grace. This arrogance is a major wall, protective wall, and proud obstacle to the knowledge of God. Someone who's arrogant will not conclude, maybe that even there is a God, or if there is a God, he's lucky to have me on his side. I have no problem with him. And nothing to worry about. No need for God's grace or mercy. So arrogance is a proud obstacle to the knowledge of God. But if in our self-knowledge we see only ruin and no glory, we are in despair or apathy or nihilism or cynicism. We think we're just dirt. We think we're without dignity, without meaning. We are just useless accidents in this world. This is also a major obstacle against the knowledge of God. This is also something that keeps us from and protects people from that. They would rather despair about meaninglessness than believe there is a God there. And I think this is very often, especially because people are so afraid of anybody who believes in God is going to be a fanatic, they'd rather embrace a meaninglessness to protect them from having to be challenged even to believe in God. The biblical prophets, apostles, and Jesus himself spent a great deal of time with high imaginative effort helping people to destroy these obstacles, helping people to pull down walls built on twisted self-understanding that they might then get a glimpse and embrace the true knowledge of God, understand themselves both as glory and ruin. For which we also, as I said, we need God at center stage. I can remember myself before I was a Christian. I was drawn to the Christian faith, among other things, because it seemed that only the Christian faith seemed to hold to the highest moral ideals and glory and excellence in the world, but also be brutally honest about how deeply flawed we were. I remember when I first went to Libri, I left, went back to France. I'd never read the Bible before. I sat down, I read the Bible in this French hotel for 3 days, straight through, and took down everything I couldn't believe in. But what struck me at the end of this 3 days was, good grief, there's a huge load of sketchy characters in this book. I mean, what a bunch of bums until you get to Jesus. But it's the brutal honesty about telling the story. You know, this is all our, this is the religious leaders of our religion are all accounted for this, and there are a bunch of bums in much of the time. And so this honesty was, I found, tremendously challenging, going together with this extraordinary high moral framework that we all aspire to. And I should say, in the ruin side and so on, in the catastrophe side here, the Christian view isn't that we're ruins and we should be resigned to it to stay there and not move. That's not stasis. There's the whole doctrine of transformation and sanctification within us, which is what I'm not going to touch on tonight. But that's that we still remain ruins the day we till the day we die, but better ruin than we were when we started. Moving to into apologetics more specifically, the use of irony in apologetics. I mean, I've used irony already here. Not as a literary device formally, but to refer to something broadly and describing two things coming together which are discordant, which are paradoxical, which are jarring against each other, but are held together somehow. As in Pascal's greatness and vileness, as in Schaeffer's glory and ruin. This is the basic irony of human nature, which we must struggle to accept and live with faithfully. The biblical writers, though, in trying to persuade other people to believe in Christ, use irony in a different way. Use irony, try and pursue irony in the life of the non-Christian in a way that is different. They to try and identify intolerable ironies that a person can't live with and shouldn't be living with. Ironies that are there because they don't believe in God and suffer from because they don't believe in God. And no one should put up with them. And so you see some of biblical apologetics, especially this negative side, as identifying some of these ironies and trying to make people face them in a very close and dramatic way. I'll pick one out of Psalm 103, which appears many times in whole form and bit forms through the scripture. It's dealing with the passage of time and the impact of the passage of time on us. Psalm 103, 15 to 16. As for mortals, their days are like grass. They flourish like a flower in the field, for the wind passes over it, and it is gone, and its place knows it no more. Here is a simile. What are we like? We're like grass and flowers that flourish in the field. This is a reference to human beauty, human creativity, success, importance, recognition, dignity, significance, praise, in doing all the things we're gifted to do. We thrive, we grow, we build, we flourish. This is our glory. This is what we're made to do as images of God, fearfully and wonderfully made. But what happens over time? This isn't a permanent state. This is just naturally ours. This picture does not last. Time brings ruin to this picture. And again, like flowers, the wind passes over it. Other ways this times this is developed, this is filled in other places in the scripture. But wind passes over it, the flower fades, it withers, it dies and disappears here, leaving no trace. In other words, it's like the flowers outside here from 3 summers ago. It's not just that this summer's flowers are faded and doomed or and sort of looking brown rather than whatever, but 3 summers ago there were flowers out there, and you won't be able to find any trace of them in the flower beds. That's what death does to us. That's what we are like, finally here. And so the tragic irony here that I think is presented to us as something we shouldn't accept, we should kick against, we should push against, but we should face it. We should engage it and realize how serious this irony is that time turns this glory and importance from dignity and significance and extraordinary human individuality to undifferentiated dust in a very short time. complete loss of the person, the identity we had once had. We can think of the connection people have had with the words from Macbeth about life in the presence of death, a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. And you can see, historically, people who've connected with that as yes, this is what I see, this is what I feel. But the psalm does not stop there. The next verse is, but the steadfast love of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him. The picture is this: time chews up human glory and spits it out and leaves nothing but dust and ashes. Unless God is at the center of your life, unless you stand with God as a person of God, and then the picture totally changes. Then his steadfast love maintains your glory, the glory of his people, from everlasting to everlasting. You know, what an incredible contrast. The protective walls keeping us from knowing God in this way are illusions and mirages about youth and power going on forever, which they don't. Illusions about death being something that happens to other people, which it doesn't. Illusions also that now we know that death is natural and friendly and we should all just get used to it. And as Flannery O'Connor said, these things are domesticated. Think of the film clip we saw last night of Sully. What we experience and the gut reaction we have through most of that is we know that human beings are contingent. They are vulnerable to all kinds of things completely outside of our control. And we live daily in the presence of all sorts of things utterly outside of our control, which could nix us in no time. And that's the world we're living in. We're not meant to fix ourselves on that. We're meant to fix ourselves on God. But God is, and God's gospel connects with that. And that's what this one little piece in Psalm 103 is connecting with, that you're like a flower in the field. And all that I've said. Okay, moving on. I'm dealing with different aspects of irony, and then I'm going to shift to humor. Heroes. I've had a thought for a long time about heroes. Wrote a book on heroism. Heroes are people who we hold in our imaginations, which represent what we want to be like. One of the most important things to find out about a person is, what do they want to become? I often ask this to our students. What do you want to become? What are you aiming at? And heroes, we often don't realize it, we don't know, we haven't thought much about it, but with careful thinking, it's interesting what emerges as to who our heroes are, because it's very, very easy to focus on good things. It's also easy to have heroes who represent everything that Jesus doesn't, even for Christians, but certainly people in society have heroes that shape them against God and all that God would draw them toward. One can be heroic in the minds of other people, but heroic for all the wrong reasons. And so they can be, again, a fortress wall or obstacle blocking God from our awareness. They are heroic in values that lead us away from God. They may be heroism from Hollywood, from Madison Avenue, from Wall Street, from anywhere, from next door, from inside your own head. They can be things that you look up to, you want to have that yourself, and yet they're nothing whatsoever to do with God or anything that would lead you to God. Such a false hero is a serious problem for Christian apologetics, because it stands between someone and even taking the Christian faith remotely seriously. For many people today, it's their hero system that demands that they say that Christianity is a wimp's religion. If that's what you believe, that Christianity is a wimp's religion, forget arguments for its truth. You're not going to touch them. You're not going to go anywhere near them. It's rejected for all sorts of, within all sorts of hero systems. You can think of some yourself. Your imagination and your heroes have enormous power over you. In your life. And I think one of my grievances is I think the whole imagination at this point of especially one's desires and one's heroism, sense of heroism and glory is radically ignored in our construction on the Christian life. We don't spend enough time with it. How does the Bible free us from these obstacles? Not by lectures, not by arguments. The Bible confronts us in our confronts our imagination with imaginative things aimed at our imagination. My view is that it is confronted by the fool in the Bible, or the ironic exposure of fool worship. I'll just give you some examples. The Bible confronts our imagination directly by reframing the false hero and showing who you think to be a hero is actually a fool. The fool in the Bible is usually not stupid, but he or she is someone always who is arrogant before God and humanity. The false hero always ends up being the fool, meaning being a loser and a jerk. In other words, someone you can't relate to. It's about building aversion as opposed to aspiration. Heroism is about aspiration. Exposing fool worship is about how to build aversion. The Bible, if you think about it this way, unlike so much modern literature, never allows evil to be glamorous. Doesn't allow evil and folly to be attractive. It's always inspiring aversion. So that it frees our imagination to connect with God to be able to follow one day real heroes. Example, Proverbs 26:8. This is about the whole philosophy of the function of a fool, really. It is like binding a stone in a sling to give honor to a fool. This means to the person who gives honor or heroic stature to someone who's really a fool, this is like binding a stone in a sling. Now look what's going on. This is asking you, by the way, to write a skit, to form a skit, to act it out at least in your mind. You tie a rock into a sling, into the pocket. Now the sling would have a pocket to hold the projectile. You tie it in carefully, maybe very, very tight with rawhide or something like that, and you go out as the mighty hunter. And you see the game and you release the sling and you let go one end of the sling to go and kill the game. And what happens? The rock comes back and whacks you in the head because you've tied it into the sling. Okay? Now this is what we're meant to envisage, because this is exactly what he's talking about. The mighty hunter. And anyone who gives honor to a fool, that's what they're like. He's giving you a picture. You framing it in your imagination. You should make Charlie Chaplin do this, or Woody Allen be doing this, or someone who would do it well. Be the fearless hunter. Now, there's a rich development of the fool and his cousins through wisdom literature. Cousins being the sluggard and the scoffer and so on. You could just go through and see them yourself. All helping you getting rid of false heroes who are lodged in your imagination, who are very difficult to get out, by the way, because they've been there for a long time, maybe since your early childhood, but are obstacles to the knowledge of God. Proverbs remind us of another major obstacle to the knowledge of God, which is the heroism of male sexual conquest. The heroic stud, enormously powerful in a world that sees sexual freedom as one of its major idols. It doesn't see them as idols. I see them as idols. Sexual freedom is one of the things. If you want to really make people mad, question sexual freedom, and you'll get an avalanche on your head. So do it with shrewdness if you do it. But okay, does the Bible see the heroism of male sexual conquest? Well, it's interesting, and it's a really jarring one. The heroic stud who's successful with the woman is, quote, like an ox that goes to the slaughter. Whoa! Where does this come from? Where does this go? But you're meant to get a hold of this and hang on to this and understand this is what we're being told is true about it. And maybe it's easier for us now after the Me Too movement to see something of some of the top media executives lining up like oxes going to the slaughter. And it's easier to see the logic of this very imaginative exposure of it in our time, easier than it's been in times before. So male sexual conquest seems less heroic in certain ways. Also, I'm afraid for women, too. Like a gold ring in the snout of a pig is a beautiful woman without sense. What do you do with that? What do you do with that extraordinary image? I mean, come on. But it's there, and you're meant to do something with it, not just go on to the next verse and flip the pages and then go to your New Testament reading. It's both of these are visual things that jar you, that wouldn't necessarily connect at all with what you're used to, but they're powerful, jarring, ironic visual images aimed at dethroning a hero system, dethroning a set of heroes in your mind so that are obstacles to you of the knowledge of God. You're invited to construct them as visual images and let their irony work on you. And this is an irony that smashes the authority of a false heroism. Irony that you don't want to live with and shouldn't have to live with. Irony is always, it's always that the fool who's seen as a hero is revealed to be, at the denouement, pathetic in reality. Jesus' parable, the rich fool, is an intriguing example of someone who's certainly a major corporate success story, a corporate hero. He's made investments. He's built his farm. He's building bigger barns. He's done all sorts of things done. He's a man who knows how to get things done, who knows how to control things and make them work the way he wants to. And God says to him in this parable, "You fool. This very night your life is being demanded of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves and are not rich before God." Now, it's not that his problem was that he was rich or that he was successful, but that his whole set of priorities had nothing to do with God. So Jesus doesn't give him a moral lecture. He just says, "You fool. You've got life completely wrong, and you've ended up losing all the things that you wanted." And it struck me just looking at this most recent time, the last thing that struck me is that he didn't even have time for a single party, because he said, "This night your life is required of you." So he didn't even have time to do one party. This man whose life was control and controlling things successfully and making them work for him and fitting together and getting rich and accumulating all this stuff, God nowhere to be seen, and doesn't even have time for one party. Shifting to Jesus' ministry more, and I'd love to go on more with this, but I really wanted to share. Why was it that Jesus got busted all the time for healing people in the synagogue on the Sabbath? At the start of all the Gospels, he's getting busted again and again. And other times, not even in the synagogue, he managed to, lots of times. What's the matter? Didn't he remember that this was illegal? What's the story? I think it is, in fact, a shrewd strategy. Remember, what he was walking into was a highly legalistic religious system which had one of their important absolutes was observing the Sabbath correctly. You could do no work on the Sabbath, but you have to decide what is work. You have to define what is work. They had done that. They had defined 39 categories of activity which were work. And then the scribes move in, and they describe, and they give you all sorts of, gave them all sorts of qualifications, exemptions, clarifications, and loopholes around those 39 categories. So the literature on Sabbath observance was massive. This was the scribes. This is what they did for a living. Probably the closest thing today would be modern tax lawyers. But healing, among other things, healing was considered work, and therefore not allowed on the Sabbath. You could bandage, and again, how does this work? They'd worked out how it worked. You could bandage a wound to stop the bleeding, because that was just keeping it from getting worse. You couldn't put ointment on the bandage on the Sabbath, because that would be to heal it, not just to stop it from getting worse. Do you see the logic there? So ointment on the bandage was work, and so illegal on the Sabbath. It was somehow at this point of healing that Jesus decided to make his challenge. You see, this is the beginning of the gospel story. He's coming, he wants people to know, the kingdom of God is here. I am bringing in a new approach to religion. It's part of your religion that you've grown up with, but in other words, it's not at all. And listen and note what's going on. There's something different happening here. And this is how Jesus, one of the ways he is getting this across.
Jesus could have taken all these people out behind a bush in back of the synagogue and healed them after the service. He said, meet me after the service. We'll just go up behind a tree and we'll heal you there. He didn't. He could have told them to wait till sunset, for crying out loud, because the Sabbath was technically over at sunset. You just hang around and we'll meet you after sunset and I'll do it then. He didn't. He obviously got busted on purpose. Luke 13, I'll read you one of these examples. Jesus was teaching in the synagogue on the Sabbath, and he noticed a woman who was crippled. He called her over. It was his initiative, not hers. And healed her, whereupon the synagogue leader was indignant and freaked out and lectured him and lectured all the other people, never come in here wanting to be healed on the Sabbath. Come any other day of the week, you can come and you can be healed. I don't know how he planned to heal them, but... And then Jesus turned on him and rebuked him. He says, you hypocrites, does not each one of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away and give it water? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 long years, be set free from this bondage on the Sabbath day? And Luke says, the entire crowd was rejoicing. They were saying, yes, right, praise God, or whatever. But they were rejoicing. In other words, he won them over entirely. Now, I want you to see what's happening here. It's something that's very, very astute in terms of apologetics. He was driving a wedge between their humanness, their empathy, their compassion, their love for this woman who was their friend and neighbor, and their legalistic religious system under which they'd been living for years, which required them to believe that what had just happened, this healing that had just happened, was a terrible, awful sin violating the law of God. Now, this is irony, because Jesus is putting these two things right together. Here, this woman is freed, been crippled for 18 years, and whoa, praise God, this is amazing. We've known her, she's suffered all this time, and yet, no, this is sin. What do you do with it? If you'd been there, what would you have done with it? But he was intentionally driving this wedge, and this happened again and again and again, whenever this happened. Getting their consciences to push back against their own laws and customs. Who could not rejoice at this healing? But how petty or warped any legal system is that would prohibit it. Just a footnote here, if you've studied Schaeffer's apologetics, he is forever driving a wedge between people's humanness, their experience of their humanness, and their worldview, which is inadequate to explain their humanness. This is just what Jesus is doing right here. But Schaeffer is doing it in the context of the modern world with naturalism and all sorts of things that have no room for human dignity, glory, and so on. But you see, the same legal system here that he was challenging was the legal system which told them, if I keep all the rules, it gave them the illusion that they would be righteous before God by keeping all these Sabbath rules and okay before God and not need any grace of God. Because I remember what Paul said about himself as a Pharisee. I was as to the law blameless, meaning he kept all these hundreds and hundreds of laws and was blameless in his own mind before God. Then no sense of his own ruin and also no sense of the real holiness of God. Imagine what their view of God was who would be impressed by this and satisfied by this endless, casuistic, legalistic obedience to rules. And need no atonement, no grace from God, no Messiah would ever need to go to die to save these people because they were okay already as they were. No need for grace. Okay, again, what I try to say is looking at the basic irony of who we are ourselves and then seeing how in the apologetics of the scriptures themselves, you see them sticking in our face huge ironies that we shouldn't have to live with and we wouldn't have to live with if we turned and accepted God. Now, the second part of this, is the persuasive potential of humor. I'm going to have to back up a little bit and talk about what in the world is humor. Many people have tried to define it. What makes something funny? And it turns out to be a pretty tough discussion. E.B. White, of all wonderful humorists and wise men, he concluded, essentially, it's a complete mystery. Humor can be dissected as a frog can, but the thing dies in the process, and the innards are discouraging to any but the scientific mind. So I hang with E.B. White here. and in terms of defining what makes something funny and what doesn't. But I want to be able to say something about it. And as you dredge and poke around and poke and pull around, I think you can. Going back to actually Schopenhauer, of all people, who was certainly no humorist, he said that humor was the sudden perception of incongruity. And interestingly, Chesterton picks up things that are very much like this, that it's incongruity perceived. Things are suddenly recognized as out of focus, that are strangely connected, but in an unexpected and somehow wonderful way that tickles your funny bone. I think this is as good a base as any. My suspicion is that all humor is incongruity perceived, but the hook is that not all incongruity is funny. Tragedy is incongruity as well. What makes something funny remains a mystery. Flying jet liners into skyscrapers is certainly incongruous, but not many of us thought that was funny. Though some people with a different worldview in a different place evidently did think it was funny. So we still have humor as a mystery, but we know something about it, that it's incongruity perceived. The bits and pieces of it are so different. All the human differences between people mean that people have different kinds of styles of humor. It relates to your age, your sex, your class, your ethnicity, geography, occupation, historical period. All that affects what you think is funny. You think some funny things are funny now that you wouldn't have earlier, and vice versa. You take Gary Larson's Far Side cartoons, and I'm hoping this is some sort of safe turf. Go on here for generic humor. He starts with a whole paradigm of incongruity, of laying that out by giving animals human language and human technology, okay? Right away, that's incongruous, okay? All these animals have cell phones, cars, chemistry labs, suburban houses, the full range of appliances. He can create nearly an infinite number of cartoons, which I think most of them are funny, given that basic incongruity that he's starting from. I'll restrict myself to just one, a single-frame cartoon of two amoebas sitting in their chairs at home watching a film projector. They're watching films of pornography, lewd pictures of cell division. And so you can go anywhere once you've made that shift and allow animals things that animals don't have. I wanted to read you a piece that will take me a minute that will hammer home to you the fact that humor is really about incongruity perceived. This is out of a course catalog of a liberal arts college that one of our sons went to. Some years ago, a National Education Journal recounted a story of a professor called in to mediate a dispute about a grade. A student in a certain physics course had been asked to explain how one could determine the height of a tall building by means of a barometer. The answer was given an F, and the student objected that, on the contrary, the answer was perfectly correct according to the accepted laws of physics. When an outside mediator was called in, he had to agree that the student had a point. The answer given was go to the top of the building, tie a string to the end of the barometer, lower the barometer to the ground, and measure the length of the string. Nevertheless, it was agreed that the student should be given a second opportunity to answer the question more straightforwardly. After 6 minutes of the allotted 10 had been used, the student had not written anything on his paper, and the mediator asked whether or not he did not know the answer. No, he replied, it's just that there's so many answers. I'm trying to decide which one to give. Near the end of the time period, he quickly scribbled down an answer. This time, the instructor in the course capitulated, and the student was given an A. The answer was, take the barometer to the top of the building and drop it off. Time the fall, then by the well-known formula for the rate of the acceleration of falling bodies, you calculate the height. The mediator was fascinated with the ingenuity of the student and asked whether he really had other answers. Of course, he replied. Take the barometer out on a sunny day. Measure the shadow cast by the barometer and the shadow cast by the building. Then, knowing the height of the barometer, you can calculate the height of the building. Or a very simple direct method would be to start at the base of the building and measure the building by laying barometer length, the barometer along the walls to determine the height in barometer lengths. Finally, of course, the easiest method would be to go into the basement and find the office of the superintendent, knock on his door, and when he answers, say to him, "Here, I have this very fine barometer that I will give you if you tell me the height of the building." Now, you see, the whole point is what he would not do is to use the barometer for the one thing that was congruent with the barometer's designed purpose. You see what I'm saying? So that's just to help you remember the connection between humor and incongruity. How can humor work? Now we're getting to the use of it and why I think it's important. And here I'm going to omit all sorts of misuses of humor for destruction. And I won't need to explain anything. You all know that, what that's about, and have experienced that. But I'm not dealing with that at all. Dealing only with a certain way of constructive humor. Humor rightly used can be a great gift of God. In the light of the ironies that I've talked about earlier and spoken, it can start to challenge those themselves who live in one dimension only, only glory or only ruin. Either all glory or all ruin. All greatness or all vileness. All arrogance or all despair. Humor can lift our sense of self, our value and our dignity, and bring us up from despair to hope. Humor can also be a corrective to inflated pride and arrogance and pull us down from arrogance to humility. It can show us that we're not all glory and that we're not all ruin. In other words, it can move us toward a vitally important self-understanding. It can shift us. The sociologist Peter Berger claimed that totalitarians, dictators, and fanatics don't laugh. They don't have senses of humor. They need life to be in one dimension only. No incongruity. Only one truth, one way of doing things, one name on the ballot. But people who live under dictators and totalitarian regimes need to develop a rich humor. Humor being a certain kind of incongruity that helps them be aware that there's something, some reality other than the one that they're living under. Not just one version of reality, not just one story, but two versions at least. Incongruity that will help them safeguard their sanity, that they not be crushed in their suffering as if the power of their oppressors was the only story. It helps one to believe in justice and dignity, that they exist, even though we can't see any from where we stand. People often talk about the rich humor that was developing in the Soviet Union, USSR, pre-1989. They told, I'll give you two examples. They told of a new stamp that was issued by the state with Stalin's picture on it, with big fanfare about how we're initiating a new stamp. But it was discontinued because the stamps wouldn't stick to the envelopes. And this was because people always spat on the wrong side of the stamp. Or what is the definition of a string quartet? Think that would be simple? No, it was the Leningrad Symphony Orchestra after a concert tour in the U.S. Now, you see, if you can laugh at any of these things, it makes you less under the heel of your dictator. If you can laugh, you've got another reality that you know is something true, and you know also something truer than the political structure above you. Laughing at yourself can blow your own arrogance to pieces. Seeing yourself suddenly as ridiculous can help you see the truth, can help you destroy proud obstacles to the knowledge of God, if you can laugh at yourself as you hold these things. If you can laugh at yourself, a big if, and that's the tricky thing in apologetics, to say something that's encouraging someone to laugh at themselves without them seeing it as an insult, without being, you've got to know someone well, you've got to be very sensitive to do this well. Job was not particularly in a laughing mood, but God asked him, "Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion?" You know, absurd exaggeration in terms of what he was asking them, but a lot of those questions at the end of Job 38 to 42, 41, are hugely unrealistic things that Job is meant to get a hold of to be able to finally laugh at his presumption of some of his earlier accusations against God. I have lots of sympathy for Job, so I'm not trying to put him down, but to understand God's questions to him, it's hard to not see humor in some of those questions. Jesus' humor also usually, I think, had an apologetic edge to it. He would do radical exaggerations to the point of absurdity, and I think many people would have smiled as he heard them. Certainly many people have since. He asks in the Sermon on the Mount, "Why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye but not notice the log in your own eye? How can you say to your neighbor, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' while there's a log in your own eye? You hypocrite." You know, persuading someone that they are a hypocrite is a tough sell. But so you've got to be careful doing it. But he's doing it here with humor, with a thing that's hard to know how they would avoid the humorous component in this of someone, or as one preacher said, pretending to be a blind oculist. You know, to be an oculist, but with a log in your own eye, this ridiculous image. I think it could stimulate a sense of the ridiculousness of our hypocrisy, of our going fishing in everybody else's trouble and seeing nothing at home base in terms of what's the matter with ourselves. This historically, it just had a tremendous power to unmask people in the 2,000 years since Jesus has said it. I think partly because of the sheer humorous component here. It can soften it can make us see ourselves with humor as well as with self-condemnation that's justified. Then you hear him in a more severe light the last week of his life. "You blind guides, you strain out a gnat and swallow a camel." Again, this is a ridiculous exaggeration, but trying to get them to see how their legalism can be understood, how you neglect the great things of God for the tiny, have you tithed this much of these herbs in your garden, or not on the Sabbath or whatever. But humor of exaggeration and satire, cutting hard, but with humor. And the humor helps it cut harder in order to help you see, in order to help you have traction on the truth of God. I'll give you one example here to the end of a modern sermon of someone using the same sort of exaggeration in apologetics. This is a piece of a sermon by the late Peter Gomes, who some of you know was a chaplain for many years at Harvard's Memorial Church, the congregation in the middle of the Harvard Yard attended by Harvard professors and ever so respectable liberal citizens of Cambridge. Okay? I listened to Paul Tillich preach there when I was a student there, and this guy somehow survived for about 20 years as the chaplain there because of tremendous shrewdness, great humor, and real apologetic skill. Because this is what he said. He preached on a sermon on Matthew 21:31. Jesus said to them, "Truly I say to you, tax collectors and harlots go to the kingdom of God before you." This is to this hyper-respectable congregation of academics and so on in the middle of Harvard Yard. It goes like this. And he's talked about about Rahab, the harlot from Jericho, and how she packed in everything. Well, the minute she knew God was God, she gave up everything to go with God and God's people. "Unlike Rahab, we are unwilling to give up what we have and what we know to risk going with God. Rahab had everything to lose, and she gave up everything to go with God. The trouble with us is that we don't want to lose anything and are unwilling to give up any of it. Let me keep my intellectual superiority, my economic security, my social stability. Let me keep my habits and my ways. Let me keep my timetable and my priorities. And indeed, let me keep even my anxieties and my neuroses. We say to ourselves, then, if God can fit into that, I will pencil him in. That's why the harlots and even the despised IRS drones will get to heaven before you. Now, he says that in that setting, and I think, whoa. This is humor, I think, well used to get to give what would otherwise be, I mean, he still kept his job after the sermon. He even published this in a book. Because they heard it, and many people did hear it, who had had there'd been nothing else to hear in that place for years before he came. Okay, I've tried to show two kinds of irony, two uses of irony in the Bible. One, the irony of self-understanding, of glory and ruin that we need to accept to understand ourselves fully. And anyone needs to understand it in order to move toward trusting in the gospel of Christ. But also intolerable ironies that come on us for rejecting, as a result of rejecting God, that we shouldn't have to bear, and that are ironies that the biblical apologists push very hard, and a push to lead people to accept Christ. Then we looked at humor. And again, ways that, again, still dealing with this irony of ruin and glory, humor can be used to lift someone from despair to hope, and also to bring someone down from arrogance to humility. And again, a tremendous force spiritually, a tremendous gift spiritually to take us in either of those directions when we need it. I will end with a line from Pascal, a timeless apologist, and let him end it for us. Jesus Christ is a God whom we approach without pride and before whom we humble ourselves without despair. Amen.